All right, welcome to another episode of the Spotlight Conversations for the Postdoc Way. I'm your host, Brian Jarecki. I'd like to welcome our guest today, Idella Yambin. Idella has received her bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Chicago, and she received her PhD in cellular and molecular biology from UW-Madison. She is currently a program manager for the Center of Technology Commercialization, CTC, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Extension. Previously, she worked with Kelly Scientific Recruiting Services. So I'm very excited to have Idella here today. So she's going to give us quite a lot of information on her experiences and her curiosity about transitioning from the academic world into more of a private sector and business development role. So welcome, Idella.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Okay. Yeah, so I was hoping maybe we could start off and have you give a little bit more of a detailed background of your experience and kind of how you landed in the role that you're in right now.
Okay. So I guess I'll go ahead and just preface this with, I was always that kid that had been interested in science and in particular biology. Mm-hmm. From even the very earliest age, and so that has been really a focus that kind of guided my education and guided the activities that I got involved in. And, you know, one of the questions that you have here, you know, what are the things that guided you into the area you're in? And I'd have to say a big influence for me was my family. My mom encouraged us very strongly to be, to pursue the things that excited us and mm-hmm. to try and find areas of work that really matched with, you know, our interests. And so for me, being in the sciences, that's what I did. I went to a math and science school in Arkansas and really focused on life science, did research there, and that was really my first exposure to academic research. And when I got the opportunity and went to college, I was fortunate enough to land in a lab pretty much my second week of college. And
wow.
I worked in the same lab for all 4 years of college. So I had a very rich experience and understanding, or experiencing, I should say, what you know, long-term research looked like. And I had a very fortunate opportunity to be paired with a postdoc who really kind of shaped what I, traits that I found appealing in a mentor.
Okay.
So I worked in that lab for all 4 years, and in that lab was exposed to what a PhD education was all about. I had no idea what a PhD was. I remember asking my mentor at one point in time, what does it take to be a PhD? And he told me something that really kind of shaped my understanding going forward. And he said to me that a PhD needs to contribute something novel to the field.
Yes.
And at the time, I was like, my God, how do you contribute something novel? That's a big, tall order to do. So after I finished there, I knew I wanted to go to grad school,
mm-hmm.
But I wanted to get a different research experience because I had only worked in plants, so I'd only done that work, and I just wanted to diversify my skill set a little bit. So I worked at WashU for a year in a C. elegans lab and had a really interesting experience there in that it was a new lab, it was a new mentor, it was a new way of doing science. It was a new system, a new set of questions. And so from there, I had only wanted to take a year off. And so after that, I did the work to get into grad school and chose UW-Madison for a number of reasons, but primarily because I thought that there were diversity of students. There are people who had worked in industry. There are people who had worked in labs. There are people who were coming straight from their college experiences mm-hmm. at grad school. So there was just a diverse group of people because there were so many faculty to choose from in my program. I thought, man, I have to be able to find at least one or two people that I could work with for the next 5 years.
Sure.
And I think most importantly, people were down to earth. You know, mm-hmm. I had visited some other, Division I research institutions, and I was tired of the snobbery, so I picked a down to earth type of place.
Mm-hmm.
So I did our rotation, and I found a lab that I was interested in. And you know, all this long story really is to say, man, I was dedicated and focused on the life sciences, and so It was in about year two when I began. I had some opportunity to be involved in some mentorship experiences. Mm-hmm. I started to notice there weren't a lot of minority students, students of color in my program, and we had a really large program. And then, you know, all of these questions were like, well, this is a really good deal. Why wouldn't other people want to do something like this? Why are we not recruiting? And that kind of began the journey of seeing something else, thinking about my career in a new way, mm-hmm. Which was exciting and very scary at the same time, because all I knew was this world of academic research. I had never done much else. I mean, I had other jobs, like I was a waitress and other things like that, but my goal and pursuit was always this.
Right.
So one of the lessons I want to convey today really is take advantage of opportunity, even if it seems like it's not something anybody else would do, or people are naysaying and saying that this is a step in the wrong direction for your career. Do what you do for you.
Right.
And so I was able to pursue putting together this mentor program and working with my colleagues who are also very passionate about really exposing students to this world of research early in their college career.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time of doing that, I'm thinking, well, I don't think I really want to do this bench work. I don't think that I personally contribute. I can't contribute the type of novelty that's necessary
right.
to have a successful career and do what I was told that you're supposed to do as a scientist. I couldn't do that from the area I was coming from. I just didn't have that passion. And so this guiding principle of doing something novel was still in the background of my head, like, well, what can I personally contribute to my field? So life changes happen. I met my now husband, and he's not in the sciences, and he loves living here in Wisconsin, and I had to think, how do I balance that? And then also my own personal thoughts about what I wanted my life to look like.
Right.
Do I want to spend every single weekend in a lab? Do I want mice biting me all the time? Do I want to be dissecting things all the time? You know, the answer was no for me. And so all of these things coming together was telling me I need to really be curious and find something else that is a different fit, which was, again, exciting, but terribly terrifying, because what do I do? I don't know anything about business, which is
right.
It seems you either stay in academia or you go into industry. Those were like the two options here.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what this other world looked like. I didn't know what job titles were. I didn't know how to put together a resume. I didn't know any of this stuff because I was so academic career focused. So, again, taking advantage of opportunities, there was a minority fellows program that I participated in, and this was a week-long program where minority scientists would be your mentors,
mm-hmm.
and it was also in conjunction with the big bio conference, and that year it was held in San Diego. So we would have these, during the day session type of, it was probably 2 days of exposure to what industry looked like, different job titles, how people got into it, what were your goals and interests, how could that align,
mm-hmm.
and you were paired up with an industry mentor. And then after those 2 days, the rest of 3 days was all about the conference, and it was an immersion in networking. So I had been a relatively introverted, shy type of person growing up, and
mm-hmm.
As I grew up, I recognized that that wasn't going to serve me very well, so I really tried to make a conscious effort to push myself out of my comfort zone.
Right.
This experience pushed me way beyond the comfort zone. We were going to fancy parties, and we were, parties on boats. They had street things.
Oh, wow.
It was ridiculous, and that was my exposure to industry for the first time. Like, man, this is a rich man's world out here. So I had a great opportunity to be around a cohort of fellow graduate students and postdocs who made this a challenging and fun experience. And by that, I mean, we would go to these networking fancy parties and someone would say, okay, my goal is to talk with five people today.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get five business cards. And so I'm like, okay, well, if your goal is 5, then my goal is 7, you know? And so you go out there to really just challenge yourself and challenge your colleagues to talk with people and get business cards. And I didn't know it at the time, but that was really a great introduction to help me not only understand the importance of networking, but also really become a little bit more comfortable in my skin and understand that I have a personal networking style. I'm not going to be the person that's going to go out there into a room of people and just fool around. That's just not me. I'm going to target one person, and I'm going to talk to that one person for a good chunk of time before I target the person. It was a great way for me to become comfortable with that aspect of my personality.
Right.
So I get back from this program, and I buddy up with a friend who became kind of my career finder friend. And we just exposed ourselves to a lot of different things. We went to biotech happy hours together, and again, that having that friend to challenge you but also be a safe place to kind of talk about the experience, which was really great. We participated in the Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Boot Camp together, and from that we decided to do the Borough Business Plan Competition together. Again, all of these things exposed me more and more to what, you know, elements of business were, and become a little bit more comfortable with moving into this world. So, time to graduate, and I'm applying to all these jobs, and people are like, no, you're overqualified, no, you're not qualified, no, this isn't a fit. And I'm so very discouraged, because I'm like, as a scientist, right, you go into a new situation, and it's your job to figure it out. You read, you talk to people, and I'm thinking, I can apply those same skills to this, why won't anybody give me a chance? And so another lesson learned in that was that you really have to find something that is a fit for you. And so by that I mean, if I was applying to all these bench positions, I really didn't want to be a bench scientist anymore. So of course it really wasn't a fit. The other thing is I had horrible interviewing skills. Horrible. I look back now and I think about the answers I gave and I'm mortified. And so it's fortunate that a position came up as a recruiter for Kelly Scientific. And when I think recruiter, I had never worked with a recruiter, but I always had a negative connotation of what a recruiter was. And so I don't know why, but I was like, well, this seems good. I'm going to go ahead and take this position. I know why. Because I was excited about the team I was working for. I thought that they were genuine people. I thought they were nice people. I thought that they really, truly had an element of concern and care for the people they are working with. And when I went in to do my interview, I was real and honest. I said, these are the things I'm passionate about. I want scientists to be more exposed to this. I think that they need to have more understanding of this world. And like, I went down my list of things that I personally was passionate about. And they said, oh, well, we have this future science program that maybe you're interested in, and maybe you could do that. And so they were really open to meshing my ideas with, you know, the goals of the organization. And so it kind of became like a postdoc, you know, in that way I was able to create something new. So I was very fortunate in that role. I did become a committee leader for their Future Scientist program, and I worked with colleagues on the East Coast, and the following year I worked with colleagues in the Midwest, and that gave me a perspective of, like, really what is the job world looking like in the sciences, not just the life sciences, but in a variety of different scientific disciplines across the country, realizing that there were silos and pockets of industries that thrived in other areas, in one area, not in another, realizing that there were certain skill sets. I mean, this whole world of, like, what it takes to be hired, I was so naive to it. This really was an exposure to, like, really, what does money mean? Really, what does job title mean? Really, what do businesses need to do for their bottom line? And what does that mean for the employees? And what does that mean for me to be continuously employable in this world? And so all of these things I would not have understood had it not been for Kelly. And I got to see an array of scientific positions. And I worked with an array of different companies across Wisconsin. And it really... it was really eye-opening. But I, you know, being a recruiter is not an easy position to be in. It is definitely a very sales job, and especially, you know, I graduated in 2010, and so, you know, we were in economic chaos, and still are in some senses, and so it was really a difficult job. I did well, I must say I did well, and I learned a lot about myself in that, that I have some salesmanship skills that I didn't know that I had, that will serve me well moving forward, but I also didn't have the, you know, the hunger that a salesperson really has to be a lifetime salesperson. And so I needed to try and find something else that would give me a different set of skills. So this opportunity came up with the Center for Technology Commercialization. And I was excited because the intent of the program is to help individuals with technology innovations, help them commercialize their projects, really help them figure out what initial stages of funding are and what are, how to craft a good proposal. And and this is, I've only been here since January, so I'm still in my learning, but it's given me a new perspective of what small business looks like and what it takes to be a competitive small business and what resources are out there and how difficult the landscape really is for a small business. So that's kind of how I've gotten to this point in a nutshell.
There's quite a lot of nuggets of information in there. So I'm hoping to kind of go back and have you elaborate on a few of them. Now, you had mentioned early on that you found yourself maybe a little bit disillusioned or disinterested in doing bench science for the long haul, but you still, in the back of your head, wanted to do something novel. So I'm curious, was there a point where you were sitting at the bench and then kind of splitting your time doing the research, you know, writing publications, doing some mentoring, interacting with other people in the lab, and then you were splitting time with some of these networking events? Was there a specific point where you just kind of looked at yourself and said, this is, I can't do this bench work over and over and over? I'm curious if you had this revelation when you were at a networking event, when you're outside of the lab, or was it something you had a revelation about while you were inside of the lab? And maybe, you know, people always go back to the monotonous routine of pipetting and, you know, running blots over and over and over and just getting frustrated, hitting the wall, and really not seeing the bigger picture from there. And I think, you know, going back and listening to some of your comments, it sounds like you started getting immersed in this business world and you maybe started seeing the bigger picture and the way this money kind of works outside of just the academic lab. Even though academic labs should, in theory, be run like a profitable small business, I think many are not. So I'm curious, did you have the revelation while you were sitting in the lab or while you were at a networking event?
Yeah, I think it was an evolution. You know, I think I had an inkling around my second year, right before I was doing my prelims. And I remember thinking to myself, am I going to make it through these prelims? I've never quit anything, which is probably not always the best of things. Sometimes you need to quit things. But, you know, it was somewhere in there that I was like, this is not necessarily for me. It was really a lot of looking at my professors. I mean, I had worked in a Howard Hughes lab as an undergraduate. I worked for, you know, a good lab when I was as a technician. I was working, you know, for a lab that had been in operation for a bit of time when I got to grad school. So I had worked in, you know, very different labs, worked for very different people, and, you know, the thing that I started to look more closely at was family. I had a life change, I think, right before I went to graduate school. I had a death in the family, which really prompted me to start thinking a little bit about how I wanted to, you know, how I wanted my own non-work life to be. Right. And so as I'm looking as my colleagues and my mentors and seeing the sacrifices that they were making for their families and whatnot, and also not really seeing, you know, they weren't necessarily super happy about everything. Crunching. And I'm like, you know, this doesn't seem like a great work-life balance for me. And so I think that in there is when I started the search of thinking, well, what's gonna be a good work-life balance for me? And that's kind of what led me down the road to being curious about other opportunities.
Okay. So how did your advisor at the time, there's actually two questions in here. How did your advisor feel about you going to all these events and not spending, you know, the 10, 12, 13, 14 hours in the lab, and kind of doing what's expected of somebody in a PhD position and at academia and at bench science? And on top of that, was there ever a conversation, a direct conversation you had with your mentor ahead of time to kind of lay out what your expectations or what your plans are? And the reason I ask this, you know, you and I have worked on a few events now and have seen, you know, just in the short 2 or 3 years, I think at least since I've been here, I've seen just a dramatic shift in the mentality of how to mentor and how to guide people into what comes next after their bench training or after their academic training, because I think more and more people are starting to realize that, you know, it's impossible for everybody getting a PhD to get a job in academia. So I'm curious if this is something you recognized early on and you had a discussion with your PI about, or did it come around about and he maybe sat down and said, I see you going to all these networking events. What's your ultimate goal? What's the plan here?
Yeah, so those are funny questions because, yes, I did have a conversation, and no, it did not work out very well. So by way of understanding a little bit of my personality, I'm the type of person that pretty much is going to do what I think is right for my career.
Sure.
I'm stubborn, very stubborn in that way. It's a great skill, and it's also a detriment too. So when I was in the lab, I mentored a student after my prelim. I mentored a student every single semester in my lab, except for maybe my last semester when I was writing my dissertation.
Okay.
But that was something that I felt very passionate about, and it was also something that my advisor was on board with me on because you know, extra hands, extra work, extra get stuff done.
Sure.
The other element about me is I'm pretty organized. You know, when I joined this lab, part of the reason I joined it is I saw a vision of what the experiments needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I pretty much had all three chapters of my lab, my thesis written, in my rotation, because I just knew what needed to be done because it was just it had been something I had done prior to coming to grad school. I just knew how the work needed to be laid out. It was a different system. It was a different, you know, different assays, but I just knew that this is what needed to get done. So I had a sense of organization about what needed, you know, what the work was going to look like.
Okay.
And so from my advisor's point of view, while I was setting up the mentor program and doing some of the non-industry things outside of the lab, she didn't say anything to me because I was getting things done. If it meant I had to come at 3 o'clock in the morning to get something done, I was going to do it because my goal was to get done with school, period. I wanted to graduate.
Sure.
But when I started to get involved in doing industry stuff, I remember when I applied for the Minority Fellows Program, she kind of poo-pooed that a little bit. I don't know why. It was a week-long program. It'd be like going to a conference, but she kind of poo-pooed that. So, okay, whatever. I had some mini conversations with her and my committee about, you know, thinking about doing something outside of academia. And I remember kind of the look, and, I don't remember exactly what was said, but I got the impression that, oh, well, if you're not going to be in academia, then you're not going to do these things as rigorously, and we don't have to look at you as rigorously. And it's kind of like, oh, you're not as good enough to be in this realm. So it was very self, it was a little bit of a confidence poker, I guess, in that. And then I had an opportunity to kind of be involved in doing some independent market research for an individual that I'd met through the web program.
Okay.
And so that was more time, that I was doing that. And I remember talking to my advisor ad hoc and saying that this is something I wanted to do. I wanted to look into this. It wasn't going to take time away from the lab, but, I wanted to make her aware that this was an area I was spending some time in. I didn't even know why I told her because I would have done it on nights and weekends anyway, but I just talked to her. Sometimes things fall out of my mouth. And I remember her looking at me with this, like, blank stare, And then she said, and she like got real flustered and she shook her head no at me. I remember her shaking her head no. And I was like, ain't nobody gonna shake their head no at me. I was like, what? And she said to me that my productivity is what fuels her grant. And I was like, well, then we need to get some papers out. What are you talking about your productivity? If I wait for you, I'm never going to get nothing done. So these conversations all led to me saying, I'm going to do what I need to do. And I'm going to do it on the side, and I'm not going to tell her nothing about it. And all she needs to know is that my papers are getting written,
sure,
that my work is getting done, that all the extra experiments that she wants me to get done and the committee needs me to get done are going to get done. I'm going to do it. I'm going to tell you anything about what's going on inside, because you don't understand and you're not encouraging.
Yep.
And it's for exactly that reason that you mentioned, is that people are starting to realize that not everybody can go into academia. And we need to find ways to encourage people to look outside, because it's just, there's a bottleneck. And there's no way that all of us graduating are going to be able to find jobs in the academic world. It's just not going to happen. And that's what the mindset I was having. I'm like, there's no way that I'm going to be able to find a job in the academic world like this. And so you telling me no is just dumb, and I'm not going to listen to you because it's stupid. So
that's there's so much overlap, I think, with what you just stated and so many other individuals I've interacted with, and telling a version of that exact same story in one way, shape, or form. And it's really interesting to see from both sides of the story how the interpretation is different and how the perspective is different. So, for example, there's a conversation I've been part of on LinkedIn over the last week, and the question was, is it, you know, viewed as favorable, or is it is one able to do an internship while they are working as a postdoc or working as a graduate student? And there were several graduate students that weighed in and said, you know, this would be a good option, this is something you should do, and kind of weighed out the logical, very similar scenario that you painted with, you know, there's a bottleneck, and having additional experience is going to give you that competitive edge if you do decide to go outside of academia. Individuals that transitioned from academia to industry obviously thumbs up and said, this, you know, this is your a primary chance to distinguish yourself and pick up some of those skills you're not going to get into academia that eventually you'll find out you actually need. And there was a professor that weighed in, maybe one or two professors that weighed in and mentioned a few lines that stuck out in my head. Again, very similar to what your PI had mentioned, the productivity is directly tied to how many hours you spend in the lab, and your metric of success, which then becomes your publications, is essentially directly related to how many hours you're spending in the lab. And I took a great offense to that, because it seems like anybody can continue working in a lab and sitting there producing data, producing results, writing publications. But in my opinion, again, the bottleneck comes down to how efficient your lab is at actually getting those publications out.
Thank you. That was a big frustration there, because we were not getting publications out in a quick manner, and I was offended by that statement. But also, now that I've had a little bit more perspective, I also understand that there's some weight on her too. I mean, like, as much as getting the family, you know, getting these publications out, she has her own personal life and her family life and juggling the types of things, and it is as much stress on the graduate student to try and find and diversify your skills to get a job. It's as stressful on them, because their continued success is, you know, dependent upon what their students do.
Exactly.
It's a really big trust relationship, how much work they're putting in. But even at that, once they graduate, where are they going?
Right.
You know, I mean, that is how their success is measured. And the two perspectives butt up against each other, and it's difficult. And so I don't feel bad. I'm not angry or hostile or whatever, because she's in a perspective that, you know, causes her to think and behave in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's completely fair. Like you mentioned, PIs are under significant stress to fundraise, make sure that their lab can stay funded, make sure that they're getting publications out, and make sure that they're able to train people, that there's a cycle of people coming into the lab. So, I can understand that stress. But at some point, too, and I mentioned this in the conversation I was having online, is this should be a conversation you have early on with trainees. And the question needs to come up is, how do you define success? If you and your PI define success as 10 papers in the 4 years that you're going to be in the lab, 5 years, that's great. You guys are both in agreement. If you define success as getting 3 or 4 publications, kind of meeting the general requirements of what's expected on both sides, but also to spend any of the additional downtime you may have, if you're efficient and you're very well organized, spending some time getting skills outside of the lab and outside of just, you know, reading papers. You know, again, this can come with networking events. This can come with attending conferences that aren't necessarily geared towards academic society conferences, maybe a bio conference or a technology transfer conference. But getting these additional utilizing these additional opportunities to get yourself exposed to industry, or at least some of the other options, so that you're able to generate a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C, sometimes a plan D, that you're prepared, so you're not walking out at the end of the day, your contract's up, or you've defended, and you're kind of looking around saying, well, I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do next. And I think a lot of people in academia just choose that path of least resistance most of the time, and the next easiest thing to do would be continue on to a postdoc, and then kind of assume that you are in the crowd, the likelihood that you'll be in the crowd of getting that that academic faculty position. And it's unfortunate, because I think this conversation really needs to happen before you start your PhD.
I think you're right, and I think that it helps to have, you know, podcasts like this and and other ways to expose students to what is required to have a career outside of. Because I was not sophisticated and aware enough to be able to even have that type of dialogue. And so I think that that's what a lot of people are coming into. Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, is that it's a different way of careering. When you are doing an academic career, it's a ladder career. You do step A to B to C to D, mm-hmm. you know, and all of these things are a launching off point. I mean, I think even earlier in my graduate career, the thought is you have to do a postdoc in order to go into industry. You have to do it. And that's just not true anymore. I don't know if it's not been true because of the whole economic craziness that we've gone through, or it's just the maturity of how the biotech industry has evolved, and it's just required different sets of skills of people. But, you know, the laddering mentality is ingrained in us, and that's not the way industry works. It's a lattice type of careering where you just kind of are building skills here and there, and it's a hodgepodge, and that's how you move into developing a career. You know, when you get your job out of school, that's not a career. You're not a salesperson. You're not a project manager. You're not a bit. That's not a career. That's a job. Mm-hmm. And 20 years from now, you may have developed a career. And so it's just a different way of thinking, and it's hard. It's a hard way, and it's a hardship, and it's just, so I try and give people latitude. It's our responsibility as individuals to do what you need to do, and it's never too late to turn around and to redirect. It's never too late.
Right. Yeah. And I would definitely agree with that. I think one of the points you mentioned is being able to kind of take charge of what you believe in and what you think is best for your career. And unfortunately, I think that's probably the biggest fighting point, or one of the most difficult points to bring up with your PI, because your PI assumes that they know best. And when you start telling them that you know best, you want to be able to take charge and shape your career. I think that's when you start to have confrontation and things become uneasy. I mean, PIs have spent a lot of time getting to where they're at, and you can definitely appreciate that. But at some point, you have to wonder if your ultimate goals are aligned the same way. Like you mentioned, it ultimately comes down to you taking charge of what you want to do, setting goals for yourself, and making sure that you're meeting those benchmarks. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, you have a contract position, and once you're done with that, more often than not, your PI is not going to be able to open up all these doors for you and say, just pick and choose wherever you'd like to go.
Right.
You know, it's wherever
right.
It's all available to you. You have to do some groundwork. Actually now you have to do significant groundwork to make that happen,
yeah.
especially if you want to transition out. So
yeah.
I think, you know, I completely agree with many of the points that you've brought up. And one of the things I wanted to get back to is once you had that conversation with your PI and some of your advisors that you weren't going to continue on in an academic postdoc, how did that, you know, how did their perception or their, you know, the interaction that they had with you after that, how did that go down? I'm curious because, again, these are people that you would assume you're tightly tethered to for reference letters. And if, you know, you no longer need them necessarily for reference letters, how did they feel they can help you out moving forward?
Yeah, that, you know, that is, I remember as I was kind of throwing out random things that I might want to do, mm-hmm. the question, of course, always comes up, what do you want to do after you get done with this, if it's not going into this path? And I was like, well, maybe, you know, because I'd done the mentoring thing and I had met some faculty outside in this realm, and I thought, you know, maybe like an education type of thing might be mm-hmm. interesting. And I remember the look was like, oh, education. And I'm like, but aren't you guys in the education field too? What are you talking about?
Yep.
Oh, education.
Yep.
You know, like I'm selling myself short. And so, I mean, that's kind of how the conversation went. Nothing was ever good enough. And I mm-hmm. felt that no choice that I made was ever going to be good enough. And it just, I didn't necessarily want to tell them things. So how did it turn out for recommendations? Well, this is why I say network, network, network.
Yes.
Because my recommenders were not my committee members. They were not my PI. They were the people that I had put together the mentoring program with. It was, you know, leaders of these other divisions. It was deans of these other schools that I had worked with to, you know, get these things off the ground. Those people became my recommenders. And it's the same thing now as I transition, when I transition into this world, into this current position. You know, my recommenders were not necessarily my direct boss at my old place. It was mm-hmm. the people I partnered with when I worked on the Bio4 Career Connections Conference.
Sure.
It was people I had partnered with when I was doing my presentations at different schools. It's you find your allies in this world. Hopefully, you know, they're in positions that you know, can speak to other people,
mm-hmm.
and you do it that way. And I
right.
think, for me, the guiding principle is always do something that I'm passionate about. I took the job as a recruiter because I thought I was passionate about helping people understand what this world of work
mm-hmm.
looked like. And that led into new opportunities, which led into new people that could serve as references
sure.
for me. And
sure.
so that's been my guiding principle, to try and follow the things that are passionate and things hopefully will work out. Hopefully this continues to work for it.
It sounds like it has so far. So let's talk a little bit more about the experience you had at Kelly Scientific, because I think, you know, it's a really great opportunity for individuals to get an idea of what opportunities are out there for them, first of all, outside of academia. Because, again, as you pointed out, when you start to ask people, well, what do you want to do? I mean, in my case, I've heard people say this multiple times. I either want to go in academia and be a PI. Well, what if you don't do that? Well, I want to go into industry. Okay, what do you want to do in industry? R&D, bench science. And it stops there. They're no idea of what else they can do with their skills.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, when you took that position, you're starting to see a lot of resumes. You're starting to see a lot of different personalities and different types of people coming in. How was that experience, I guess, in terms of building your perspective of what you would like to do and your understanding of what it really takes to make it during the transition into industry? And I'm curious, obviously, you would have quite a lot of recommendations based on what you saw worked and what doesn't work for people looking to follow this kind of path.
Yeah, it's hard to, I want to be able to communicate this very well, because this experience has really influenced how I see the world of work now.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that I learned, I guess, was that you need to have skills to get a job. And that should make sense, but what do skills mean? Skill means not only your soft skills, you know, your soft skills of communication, all that good stuff, and then your technical skills. It's a combination of them both that make a good job. And the error that I was making before I took the role as a recruiter is I was trying to fit myself in a box. And, you know, and the coupled with that lesson is that companies are there to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that should be common sense, duh, but making money influences everything that you do, especially your hiring.
Right.
So that means if you don't have a person that has the skills that they need right then and there to hit the ground running, they're not going to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be able to, or have a really good network so that someone can speak on your behalf to let them know that you really can come in and hit the ground running.
Sure.
So, and because of the way our economic climate is right now, that means that the money is funneled in different ways than maybe it had been done in the past. And so what may have worked for somebody that made a career transition in the industry in 2005 is probably going to be way different than 2013. So the way the money flows, that really hits your R&D departments really hard because mm-hmm. it's really expensive to do R&D. And so if a company has a choice to outsource their R&D, like buy up little baby biotech, that
sure.
kind of stuff, then that influences the type of jobs that you can get or how you're going to work. I mean, but working a baby biotech and R&D for a little bit of time, your company gets bought up, yay for the company, crap for you, because now you have to find a new job and are your skills marketable
right.
for what's available in the marketplace? And then that was another thing, marketplace. Oh, duh, jobs have a marketplace. So that means, you know, on the East Coast, you know, you have your pharma companies, you have your contract research facilities. That's kind of what you have out in here. Out in Wisconsin, we have great food industries, good mm-hmm. manufacturing. You know, we have a baby biotech kind of area, especially around the Madison to
sure.
Milwaukee kind of corridor. You know, so that's a market. So that's another thing that, oh, I need to be able to be marketable in the area that I live in. It seems so simple, but
right.
it's like these were the lessons that I had to learn. And then, okay, so what types of jobs then exist? You know, so if you... And I think people, when they're taking that step out into the world, they're thinking of things as a career. If I take a step out and I'm not a patent lawyer, or I'm not a project manager by title, or I'm not, you know, whatever, titles mean something to people, but that's not necessarily the case in industry. I mean, titles do mean things, but it's
right.
really the skills that go into the title. And so if you don't have the skills to be in that position, you know, don't think worse or not of yourself. It is an opportunity for you to develop those skills to get into that area. And so that was, you know, another lesson to myself. What does the job title really mean? And then the biggest lesson I think I've learned is, what does the money really mean? So
right.
you get paid a salary. You have a particular value to the company.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw so many people who had worked for, you know, a company for, you know, some examples where you work for a company for 5 years or so, and then they went through a downsizing event and you're, you know, no longer available. You have all these great skills. You have a PhD. You transitioned into industry. You worked in an R&D lab doing this thing for a long time. But, oh, the company downsized, and there's no other company that really does or has a need for your skill set.
Right.
You don't have a job. It doesn't matter what your title was or how much money you were making. You don't have a job right now. And so what are you going to do? You know, so the diversity of skills is important. But the other thing I saw with money is that some people would pay the most exorbitant salaries for someone, you know,
mm-hmm.
six-figure salaries for someone to come in. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to get the six-figure salary. But what you didn't know is that's only for a year. They hired you to come to do this thing for a year, and then, oh, you did this thing. Oh, we magically don't need you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to move on to something else. You know, so when people get paid a lot of money, there's a particular value the company wants out of that. And so you need to ask yourself, what am I giving up
right.
to take this money? And so all of these things have guided me. And the last thing that I'll just put out there is always, always, always have some savings, because it was just so sad to see people
right.
who know, we're making these six-figure incomes, and because of life circumstances, they don't have a job, they don't have the savings, they have kids, they have a house, they, you know, I have a PhD, there's no, why would I ever be unemployed, you know? If I were in academia, I would never be unemployed, right? Mm-hmm. But then you had to retool, and you had to get a new set of skills to be marketable, but that would mean that you'd have to go down a lot in salary, and you couldn't do that. So always live well below your means so that you constantly can transition and pick up new skills along the way. So I think I've gone through my list of everything that I wanted to communicate about that experience.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious too, that because a lot of this will come with either one of two routes, in my opinion. It'll come through networking with people. And like you had mentioned, those are the people that will speak up for you when you can't necessarily find the exact fit for a position. And then two, it comes through the resume. And I think a lot of folks in academia struggle with both of those because their communication skills about their science are fantastic generally. But when you remove them from the lab and put them into a social setting, they start to wither and they start to kind of, they shell up. They have very poor social skills in many settings because they don't understand what their value, you know, the skills, the value that they have with their skills. So
right.
You know, I'm curious to hear your perspective on that. And then additionally, you know, if you are looking for a job, you have to have a resume that sells your skills, not necessarily your bench skills only, but also some of these other skills that you may have picked up. And I'm curious if you can kind of speak on to both of those based on what you saw, again, what worked and what didn't work when you were with Kelly Scientific. And then, you know, as you were transitioning into the job, into the private sector, how you eventually modified your networking approach and how you eventually modified your resume to really hone in on what industry is looking for. Because again, I think these are both very critical points and questions that graduate students and postdocs really need to understand.
Sure. So I'll try and answer that by saying that you need to constantly show your value.
Mm-hmm.
So when you give a presentation, when you're writing a paper, you're writing it for a particular audience in mind.
Sure.
And you're going to show your value. You're going to give facts. And so that's kind of what your resume needs to do. We have a tendency to throw off everything that we've done, and that the sheer fact of having accomplished so much should be enough for them to take a risk on you.
Sure.
But that's not the case. They need to see your value. So you have to highlight, you know, what skills are necessary for that culture and for that particular job. So when you are applying for, I think the biggest thing that I saw is people would list all their publications. Well, if your publications have nothing to do with the job that they're going for or the work that that particular company does, they don't care about your publications. And in fact, almost as a deterrent, because sometimes the more information that's not relevant to them that you put on there, the more they think that you are not capable of learning and adapting to the changing environment that is industry.
Right.
The other thing too is the value statements in there. So, you know, when you say I mentored this many students, mentoring may not be the best example unless mentoring is something that the company really is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to figure out a better example. But basically, I'm trying to say have value statements that resonate with that organization.
Sure.
So you put the essays up that company does. Maybe none of your publications and the big picture questions that you ask have to do with that company, but maybe you know a lot about you know, the particular assets that they use, or maybe that background is pertinent. One of the things I saw a lot were instrument companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you have a background in protein purification, or you've worked a lot with HPLC. You know, those things are attractive to the company, but the fact that you use HPLC to do this thing, they don't care about that. So, you know, they're looking for how much money did you save something? How much, you know, if you wrote new methods for, you know, an instrument, that's something that they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
If you've, you know, they're looking for people who can That's not necessarily true. If the company's culture is one where they're looking for innovation,
sure,
then you want to try and highlight your innovation. If the company's culture is one in which they're looking for someone to come in and fill a widget spot, you want to talk about how you, you know, can do that. So networking is really key to doing that, because that's the only way really that you can truthfully understand what the company's culture is like, what they tend to look for, and use that as ammunition on your resume to speak to that particular audience.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That, again, no matter how many times you tell people in academia when they are looking for jobs, I just don't think you can get that point across enough. That you really need to spend some time tailoring every resume that you put out to a specific company and to a job that you're applying to, because again, you want to distinguish yourself from the multitude of people that are applying for the exact same position. And I think anyway,
it's hard.
It is very hard. So I'm curious, again, based on all of that and some of the experience that you had as a graduate student and then moving forward through Kelly and some of the mentoring opportunities that you had and now working in business development, what do you feel is the most valuable skill that you picked up during your graduate career?
Wow. So most valuable skill for me, I think, is really putting together a good presentation. I'm a person that, I guess I've always had a skill to talk. I mean, I was the kid that always got in trouble in school for talking too much. So for me, being able to put together a good argument and a good presentation was a skill that was important for me.
Okay.
For many, having excellent writing skills is important. It's important to note, too, that business writing is different from scientific writing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are generally a good writer and understand that there's an audience and that you need to market to an audience, you know, that's great. Grant writers, oh my goodness,
sure.
There's just such a need for people who can write grants, because especially in this entrepreneurial world that we live in here, the way that people are being funded is through small business innovation grants,
mm-hmm,
and things like that. So if you are a great grant writer, then there's opportunities for you. Being, you know, one of the things I think I got from hiring managers a lot, that this was really funny and awkward, is that scientists are not social people,
mm-hmm,
is what they tell me, and that they're not flexible, and that they don't have the skills to be professional.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I had a colleague who went to an interview to be a consultant. She's working as a consultant now, but when she went to the interview, they were like, well, you know, you can't get up and come in at 12 o'clock and wear flip-flops and work. She's like, what? What does that mean? I'm not wearing flip-flops now. What are you talking about? So, you know, I don't, mm-hmm, you know, just constantly finding ways to be, you know, professional and having a professional presentation when you go to networking events and things like that is going to be important. And then there was one last thing that just kind of sort of slipped my mind. If it comes back, I'll do that. But those were, you know, those are the big things. And, you know, I think what your graduate training does at its very core is set you up to be able to walk into a new situation,
mm-hmm,
and figure out how to orient yourself,
sure,
by doing research, by talking to people, by, you know, learning to build collaborations. These are fundamentals. And that will serve you well no matter where you go in the future, because that's just how the world is. You have to constantly be curious, and that's what a science education is about, is being curious.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. That's a very good summary of the value that one gets as a PhD student and then moving forward. So I have two more kind of heady questions for you. And I think these are, you know, I usually like to ask every single person these two questions, because I think taking into consideration their experience and the path that they followed, kind of reflecting back and putting it all together, I think is a very important feature for a lot of you know, PhD students and postdocs that are looking for advice and looking for resources. Again, there are multiple books, there are multiple websites that one can go to, but I've found, and I think many people would agree, the most valuable information one can get is from talking to an individual, from an informational interview and mm-hmm. learning from this person directly because they've already experienced everything. So rather than trying to go through some of these hurdles all on your own by yourself, trying to figure it all out, I find it very valuable to talk to somebody else. And again, these are two of my favorite questions to ask people. So again, going back and reflecting on your path. Now, if you were put in a position where you can be an academic advisor, how would you advise your trainees to prepare them for the real world as you understand it now?
Diversify, diversify. My lesson for myself was, man, I sure did focus on one thing too long. And if I could tell somebody to say, if you know at your core that you like working in a lab, great. Get some chemistry expertise, get some life science expertise, get some engineering expertise, just diversify as much as you can in that realm. If you think that maybe that's not the direction you want to go down, get some business courses under your belt and just diversify. Same thing, even if you want to go into, you know, academia and you want to do teaching or something, diversify, teach a lot of different types of courses and get a lot of different understanding of different education principles and assessment principles. Mm-hmm. Just diversify as much as you can.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I almost feel that some PIs would say the exact opposite thing. And I think that's the mentality one almost needs to have as they're moving through academic training is you actually need to diversify less and focus on one little topic more and more and more and be able to keep peeling away all the layers until you are the world's expert on this tiny, tiny little factor, this tiny, tiny little protein that really you and maybe 10, 15 other people really understand in the world. So the diversify, I can see how that is, that's advice that somebody would have after they've moved outside of academia, because again, you see that importance and how it translates into a career path into industry. So
and outside, I don't want to say just in industry, because I see how difficult it is for funding for academic labs
sure.
right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can think about your question from a different point of view because you have different experiences, then that allows you to really be competitive. So
right.
I would say across the board, for what, because nothing gets done anymore if you don't have money. So, you know, follow the money, and money follows diversification. So
mm-hmm.
diversify.
I like that. And the last question I have for you, again, now taking into consideration the role that you have now in business development, working with small businesses, how would somebody make that leap from academia into the world that you're now living in? I know your route wasn't a direct route. It was a little bit more circuitous. And, you know, feel free to pepper in some of your day-to-day activities. And this may resonate with individuals that are interested in this area. But I'm curious, you know, if somebody is very interested in pursuing business development and working with small businesses and a lot of entrepreneurs, how, you know, from your experience in interacting with others, how would you advise somebody to move into this area?
Sure, and I'll say it from interacting with others because my experience is weird. But what I see is a need for understanding what makes a business grow and thrive. And so, you know, there are terms like economic gardening and economic development centers and, you know, really truly understanding what are some of the tools and techniques that private and government sectors are using to foster the growth of companies.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that might be by getting some business courses under your belt and maybe doing some internship or consulting. Where there's so many consultants out here. There's just it's just a plethora of them out there.
Yes.
Find a consultant and say, hey, maybe I'll work for you for free, maybe do some research for you, maybe do some writing for you.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be happy with that because then that allows them to take on new clients, and you'd be happy with that because then you're going to get some exposure and some experience. You know, another way that I saw that is people who really truly go into like consulting companies like McKinsey and whatnot and smaller consulting companies. That's a whole different route. But it does expose you to strategies that are being deployed to help these businesses grow and thrive and whatnot. So, you know, from the small business development assistance world, what's working are people who have a good understanding of business and have a good understanding of the theories that it takes to make a small business grow. And so seeking out opportunities to get that learning, I think, is what would help people transition into this type of world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that again, it's a very foreign concept at you know, this, at least the stage I'm at, until you start interacting with individuals and you start to see a little bit more about what their day-to-day activities are and some of the interactions they have. And you can eventually, you know, people like myself find this very exciting. I, like you, also went through the Wisconsin Entrepreneur Bootcamp, and I just think that completely shifted my mindset of what I find interesting and, you know, how actually the commercialization of technology and developing a product, not necessarily being at the bench the whole time and working on an assay, but understanding how that assay, you know, how it adds value to the company and how the company will now take this assay and, you know, market into a product. I find that whole process, the whole idea of commercialization, just very fascinating. So, and again, you individuals don't learn about these things unless you talk to people that are, you know, that have this experience and that have these types of positions. So, again, just, you know, to echo something you said, to be to diversify your background and to actually interact with individuals and ask them questions and spend your time doing some of the legwork, I think is going to benefit everybody that's worried about what comes next significantly. So, I wanted to, again, thank you very much for coming on and giving some advice to our listeners and spending a little bit of time with us here at the Postdoc Way. I have to say, I really look forward to interacting with you again at some of these career development seminars or conferences that we'll be putting on here in Wisconsin. And I have to say, you're one of my favorite people to interact with here in Wisconsin, because you're just very upfront and honest about what people need to do to take charge of their career. I love it. There are too many people that don't say in a very upfront, genuine, honest manner what needs to be done, and I very much appreciate your comments. So I wanted to give you the opportunity here. Is there any particular way that individuals can learn more about you or the CTC, or if they wanted to connect with you, feel free to give a little bit of information here as a plug.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I have my LinkedIn account, and so anybody who wants to message me on LinkedIn, that would be fantastic, okay. Especially if they want to reference this so I understand where people are coming from. And and I do work out of UW Extension. If anybody's interested in that, then, you know, we have our website, WisconsinSEIR.org, which tells a lot more about what CTC does and program, that kind of stuff. So anybody who has questions, I always welcome the opportunity to talk, because I know it's difficult. Sure. And sometimes you just need a sounding board. And I also wanted to say thank you to you, Brian, because you really are taking things to the next level with things like the podcast. And you really are very excited about it. I know that you have your own, you know, things that you're looking into for yourself. But to be able to take a step back and try and bring others along on this journey, you know, really speaks very well to you. And I know you got a lot of things going on. I know you have a family and things like that. So I really am in awe of the amount of energy that you are dedicating towards this effort. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's quite a lot of fun. And again, I love these virtual informational interviews, because I'm learning so much about these opportunities out there and finding individuals, again, that are very passionate about what they do and are really willing to educate others, again, at their own pace and on their own time, I think is really, really great. So again, I want to thank you again for sharing your experience with us. I know it's going to be very valuable for a lot of individuals that have all kinds of questions, and I think you're going to be able, at least with our conversation here, you're going to be able to answer a lot of those questions. So again, Idella, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you too, Brian.
All right, you have a good afternoon. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.